Today is Wednesday. It's July 12th, 2023. It's 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. Thanks for listening to the Mincing Rascals podcast. We broadcast portions of this Saturday nights at 8 o'clock on WGN Radio, and that's where you can hear me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can listen to my podcast, America's Talking.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of WCIU's On the Block of Block Club Chicago and the Making Podcast on WBEZ.
I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, and you can write to me, ericzorn@gmail.com, and I'll add you to the list. It comes out every Thursday.
Thursday, Pat Fitzgerald was the best coach Northwestern University football ever had, with what looked like the safest coaching job in America, 2 years into a nearly $60 million contract. And today, he's out of a job, fighting to keep his money, if not his good name. After a six-month independent investigation, the university announced that allegations of hazing in the program were true, but that the coach did not know what was going on. So they gave him a two-week unpaid suspension. Then a former player emailed the Daily Northwestern about what was really going on. The paper found another student with a similar story. They had some corroborating evidence, including a video. Other athletes came forward. The university president said perhaps his punishment was too light, that he had erred, and a day later the coach was out of a job. Was the coach telling the truth when he said he did not know what was going on? I believe him. Should he be fired because if he is telling the truth, he didn't know? I say yes.
Well, I guess there's no way of knowing whether he's telling us the truth or not for sure. I would guess that he knew things like that were going on. There were some stories that talked about very well-known incidents like making players lie down in the middle of the field and eat watermelon with their hands behind their back and things like that, that those were fairly well-known. I would think that, you know, whether he knew about specific incidents of dry humping and so on is a little irrelevant because he clearly didn't create a culture in which this sort of thing was just unthinkable. And that's what a coach has to do. That in this day, when we've had so many stories about hazing incidents at fraternities and on teams that are really unacceptable, that a coach needs to really lead on that, and he clearly didn't. And these things were clearly more traumatizing for some of these athletes. And I just think you can't have that.
So Maggie Hickey's investigation found that the claims were largely supported by the evidence, but also that it did not find evidence that he or the other coaches knew anything about the activities, which, by the way, Maggie Hickey, I feel like, has become the, I don't know, she's like on every big investigation into anything in Illinois is Maggie Hickey. It's Madigan's sexual harassment investigation. I think the sexual abuse in Chicago public schools, that was Maggie Hickey. She's like everywhere. They call her in for Pat Fitzgerald. If this was a business doing this much revenue, like bringing in as much money as a Northwestern football team brings in, and this sort of culture was happening, whether it was sexual harassment or intimidation or otherwise in a business, the CEO would be fired. It's unfortunate that he didn't know if that's true and didn't do anything about it because he didn't know. But ultimately, it's your responsibility at the top to be sure that none of this is happening. And clearly, it seemed to have been.
Yeah, I find it hard to believe that he didn't know anything. 17 years as the czar of Northwestern football. I mean, this man lives, breathes it. And there are 25 years. To have a culture like this, you have to know something's going on, I would think. But the investigations bared out that perhaps he did not. Part of me wonders if he intentionally did not, as in a, don't tell me anything, don't let me know anything, you kids have fun, keep me out of it type of thing.
Plausible deniability, huh?
Plausible deniability. I do wonder about that. It's interesting. I played football in high school and a little bit in college. Hazing, it's part of the culture of football. Hazing to this degree is not. You know, I remember carrying pads for senior players,
right?
Things like that, having to buy lunch for team captains. But what these players had to go through, allegedly, forced nudity, forced sexual acts, or performing fake sexual acts or whatever, just the whole thing was disturbing. And the sad part about it, too, is like Northwestern is probably not the only football team in Division 1A that has something like this going on. And so there's got to be more attention paid to making sure that players feel safe, that they feel secure, and that there's a culture around a football program that doesn't allow something like this to happen. And it's just completely unfortunate that it did. Pat Fitzgerald, I mean, of all the coaches in college football, you could probably put 10 up there. You wouldn't expect anything like this from, and Pat Fitzgerald would be a name that people mention right away because of the reputation he's built, the family atmosphere he's built around Northwestern. He's just been an upstanding guy to the media, to other people in the football community. You wouldn't expect this out of a Pat Fitzgerald or a Pat Fitzgerald program, but here it is, and it's shocking, and something's got to be done about it.
He's not a fraud. That's why I think – and he's not stupid. He knows how much is at stake. So right. It does seem like maybe he was looking the other way conveniently. Maybe they did it when he was a student. Almost surely they did. I think the further you go back, the more likely it is that hazing was part of the fraternity or the company or the team culture. It seems to be less so now. It seems like we're a little more enlightened or trying to be. But he has too much to lose to let something like this go on. They got an $800 million stadium that might not happen now. His name would have almost been on that thing. He's got this $60 million deal. I mean, guys, do not do anything to screw this up. You know he had to understand that what would happen if something like this were to come forward. And lying is probably not going to work. If he had a whiff of this, he's smart enough to know that he would have to do something about it.
John, you played college football too. Did
For
you
a
get
year
Hayes?
At a junior college. And it's not even the same thing probably Brandon or any of these people that we're talking about went through. I played 2 years of college basketball, ran track for 2 years in junior college, and played on the football team. So I did have a little college athletic, but it was Joliet Junior College, and it was not a big deal. You know what was a bigger deal, though, in my lifetime was in high school, because you know how elevated and amped up everybody gets about the high school football team, and it did take place then. I mean, that was traumatizing to us little freshmen coming into the program. I just wanted to mention one other thing here. There was a study that they said that if you ask people on campus who are in clubs, organizations, fraternities, sororities, and football teams, what percentage of them went through something equivalent to hazing, it's over 50%. But only 1 in 10 of those people will say they were hazed, because they go, that's just what we did. They made us run nude through the showers, or they made us carry their pads or eat watermelon with our hands behind our back, and it was stupid. Or we had to drink a lot of alcohol. A lot of people don't even think it's criminal in Illinois, and it's not hazing. But if you say this is what hazing is, over half of the people that were asked in college, did you go through this, said yes.
It's almost like they see it as part of the norm. Right.
Yeah.
And what's really an indictment here on Northwestern is that 2 week suspension they gave to Pat Fitzgerald, as if they see it as a norm as well. Only 2 weeks. And that 2 weeks was not even, it involved no games. it was 2 weeks in the offseason. 2 weeks he probably wouldn't have missed.
It's like telling a pitcher that can't, you're suspended for 4 games, but he doesn't have to pitch for 5 or until the
exactly.
fifth game. So it's no big deal.
Exactly. So I wonder, too, we got to have energy on the NCAA. NCAA has been very heavy-handed on numerous schools for numerous violations going back to Jim Tressel, Reggie Bush, and USC. How could they see this 2 week suspension in Northwestern and shrug and say, okay, sounds sufficient, right? Like, how come no alarm bells raise in the NCAA's eyes when it came to this
investigation? Go ahead, Eric.
This actually brings up a couple of questions. You know, one is, there's been numerous reports that all of Fitzgerald's staff is going to stay, and that they're going to appoint the defensive coordinator as the interim head coach. And I don't know, you can't get a new head coach in, I think, with 2 months before the season starts. The interim coach is the defensive coordinator, was just hired in January. So he's probably not been aware of any of this stuff. The other members of that coaching staff, they are probably closer to the players and the day-to-day goings-on in the locker room than the head coach is. So how do you keep all of them around? So your question is, how far down does this scandal go? This lack of oversight go? And then the question is, how far up does it go? Does the athletic director bear some responsibility for this? Maybe he does. What about the president Schill, Michael Schill at Northwestern? He blew this big time. You know, this 2-week suspension and then having to skin it back after the Daily Northwestern, after 6 months of investigation, suddenly the Daily Northwestern comes in and in like a weekend trumps him. I mean, there's some bad stuff.
Right.
And then what that makes it seem like is that there's not actually a serious accounting for of what changes should be made to prevent this from happening in the future. And it was more about getting a scalp to avoid further media scrutiny. They basically just shut everybody up by firing the biggest guy, right? And the person with the best reputation and who is the most well known.
Well, but for the same reason you need a new head coach on an interim basis, you can't fire all of the 12 coaches that, you know, the linebacker coach.
It depends what outcome you're trying to achieve. If it's like, hey, we need to make sure that this never happens again, maybe you do jeopardize your football season a little more by, you know, firing some coaches. I don't know. But it does get to an interesting – I haven't seen enough discussion of this, and maybe I just haven't been looking for it. But I would love for – maybe there – and I'm sure there are some standards available on this, but it's like what you just said to lead this off, Brandon, about I did these things, and they were, you know, part of the culture, and it was part of character building on my team, and I thought it was good. This is where it crossed the line into something that, you know, shouldn't be acceptable in a program. Because there is something, of course, to be said for doing hard things or doing unique or odd things to be a part of a culture with a group of people doing something very difficult. That's good for team building. And I think we dismiss that at the peril of everyone who supports Pat Fitzgerald just saying like, well, these people just don't know what it's like to be, you know, in the culture of football. You have to do these things so that these are hard young men who go out and fight for their team, right? Like, why are you just being sissies about this? Like, let's do this. What specifically then are you saying? When does it cross a line, right? And that I think is actually a really useful conversation for people to have, because I don't think kids going into college know where that line is necessarily.
You're saying though that some sort of initiation is not inappropriate because it, okay, fine. But what is alleged to have happened at Northwestern, wherever that line is a long way from there, right, Austin?
Yeah.
Right.
I would agree. But specifically, where is it? Is it being forced to do something that's somewhat sexual in nature? That would seem to be a bright red line, right?
Sure.
Is it being forced drinking of alcohol or doing drugs? Absolutely. But what about, you know, you have to run a mile, you know, up the stairs in the stadium and then come down and, you know, people are throwing up because it's hot outside, right? It's like the military, like, if you go to boot camp in the military, that could be crossing a line for hazing in college football, I think, right? So there's like interesting conversations about what should and shouldn't be allowed, I think.
But it's weird the people that are defending it. It is odd to me because I do think it's so far beyond the line. And as someone that's been around the game of football, knows people in the game of football, been in numerous scrimmages, practices, all kinds of things, having dudes strip down naked and simulate sexual acts is not normal. that's not something that's part of, oh yeah, football culture. That's right. Yeah.
Well, but maybe it is. I mean, I got an email. My favorite text of the week was from a woman who said, here's my question. What's wrong with males? So this is a text from Alicia. Like, what are you guys doing? What purpose could this possibly serve, except that you're going to maybe have a class of guys that resent it or become so vengeful they're going to perpetrate the same stupid acts on the next class of freshmen?
Right.
How is that helpful to anybody?
Do women's sports teams do this, or do sororities do this kind of thing? I'm not really an expert on hazing.
Wisconsin, was it the Wisconsin volleyball team? There was some sort of volleyball team that got in trouble for hazing recently.
I think the sororities are pretty notorious for being tough on the pledges.
The sororities are too.
With, you know, drinking or humiliating games or stuff like that.
Reading about fraternity pledges who drink themselves to death. I mean, that seems to happen a couple of times a year at least, right? That pledges will, or they'll send them out in the middle of a road to do push-ups and they'll get run over by a car. I mean, this is, it's pretty gruesome what can happen. I got one other thing that comes to my mind about this, which is like, I'm not sure that the nexus between this new stadium, this rebuild of Ryan Field and this scandal is all that clear. And it seems really opportunistic of me, opportunistic of the people who are using this as an excuse to try to stop.
Who didn't want it all along?
They didn't want it all along. And they think, well, this is a, and I don't see the connection. I mean, it's, they weren't building this for Pat Fitzgerald. They're building it for the next 50 years or so of Northwestern football. And yeah, this is certainly a black eye for Northwestern, but I mean, it just seems a little bit unseemly for people to try to be taking advantage of the scandal by using it as a chip to play in their debate with the campus and the town.
Well, it's funny you say that. I think by virtue of this scandal, this is either the worst time or the most important, best time to get a new stadium, because the program has been set back so many years. What do we do to reclaim Northwestern football as a legitimate, fun program?
Yeah, right, so one and 11 team last year, and it's been set back. Think about that.
Well, okay, but that was last year. That was last year. What are you, a Michigan guy? Don't you suppose the coaches in the SEC and the Big Ten and all the other Power Five or six conferences are gathering their guys around, going, "This is what can happen, guys. Don't do this to us. Don't do it to yourself. Don't do it to the boosters." It's a good thing that most of the money Northwestern needed for that stadium has been raised, because it sure would have been tough to raise money for it right now. That stadium is there for football primarily. That football program was associated with Pat Fitzgerald primarily, 17 years. He would have been there another 20. And now he's gone and the program's disgraced. Today, three recruits said, "I'm not going to go there." Who knows what's going to happen in the transfer portal? So this is a devastating blow to the program. Stuff like this goes on at other schools.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, I think the transfer portal is closed right now. I don't think players can't defect now.
I see.
But I'm certain that recruits are going to be having trouble coming to Northwestern, and they're going to have a really hard time. And they probably ought to. I don't know what they're going to do, because already
I'm sure their parents don't want them to come. I'm sure their parents are second guessing it.
That's the thing. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, apparently one of Fitzgerald's recruiting pitches was, you're not coming here for four. This is not a 4-year commitment. This is a 40-year commitment. You're getting a Northwestern education, which is an excellent pitch, right? You're telling these student athletes, most of whom will never play a down in pro football, that this is a really valuable place to come to get a good education. So and that's still going to be true. You're just going to probably be in a program in disarray for several years. So I wonder about what's going to happen with the recruits. That's a really tough thing for the team.
The coach's son was set to play on the team this year. Pat Fitzgerald's son was an incoming freshman football player at Northwestern. So to the people who said, how could he not know, one of my listeners texted in and said, well, would he let his son play on that team if he thought that was the kind of culture that was going to happen? I don't know if the person that said that knew that, in fact, his son was going to be on the team this year. And yeah, maybe the coach would do everything he can to make sure he's running a clean program. But in a way, none of this matters, right? If it happened on your watch, the buck stops there. So the coach has to go. We're all in agreement on that. But I think I'm the only guy in Chicago who's out loud saying that I think Coach Fitzgerald was telling the truth. I just don't have an on-off switch. Like, Northwestern's on our radio station, so I listen to the games. Dave Ennett is one of my best friends. He's the play-by-play guy. He was texting the coach before he got fired. And I listen to the coach and the players before and after in our game coverage. And all of them make you feel good about student athletics. All of them make you feel good about America, and then all of a sudden we find out this happened. Now, maybe it had been going on for 15 years, but I only knew about this Friday. And now you want me to believe that this is a terrible guy who's conveniently looking the other way while his players are being abused. I just can't get my head around that fast.
It's going to be an interesting trial if it goes to trial. He is working with Dan Webb, the former U.S. attorney, and apparently it's going to sue Northwestern for breach of contract or something. I mean, he may have a claim, and it may go to trial. And it is a decent question to ask, like, what is it that you knew? What should you have known? And is should knowing something a firing offense? Is it just a disciplinary offense? You talked about other schools and what's going on there. I'm wondering if Coach Jim Harbaugh, to think of to name one coach in the Big Ten in Michigan, if he's not sitting around going, oh, you know, what's going on under me? What has gone under me? How exposed am I? How exposed are all these coaches? Because it's not just Northwestern. Come on. This happens. You were talking about the SEC. I'll bet it happens in other places in the Big Ten. And it has happened before, and that there are potential whistleblowers out there on a lot of coaches is my guess. And so I'll bet a lot of these guys are sitting around a little clenched up worrying about what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, because there could be a lot of other heads rolling at other schools if this is the standard.
Think about it. You got 120 young men circulating in and out of your program every year. And these are competitive, testosterone-filled, macho guys who've been the A-listers on all of their high school campuses and college campuses. It just seems to me like knowing where everybody is and controlling their behavior, drinking, sex, hazing, guns, violence, good behavior, bad behavior. And you're supposed to know everything that's going on with everybody all the time. And if they screw up, you're out of a job. If they screw up bad enough, you will be out of a job. But how reasonable is it to expect that the coach knows everything that's going on all the time? I think that's an unrealistic standard.
Well, you just said that's you thought fair. He should be fired. Yeah, but John, earlier on the podcast, you said you thought he should be fired. Yeah. So you think that he is. You think that the buck should stop with him.
I think the difference here, the difference is you're talking individual player by player. Should I have to be responsible for what individual players each do individually versus collective? This is a collective. The team had a culture going on. This is multiple players doing and initiating this hazing culture here. That, to me, is what makes it more so. The coach should have known. It's one thing if it's just a one player versus one player. It's another thing with all the freshmen and all the seniors.
Good point. It's a very good point, Brandon.
If it's endemic, then I don't think I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth, Eric. It seems to me like I think that's an almost impossible standard to live by, but that is the standard. You are still the top of the food chain.
That is the standard, right? Because you hear stories about college athletes doing stupid things all the time. And oftentimes it's multiple kids on the same team doing crazy stuff and getting suspended. Right. And it's never a call for like the coach's head to roll. Sometimes there is, but I don't think the standard is that, you know, it's just like being the CEO of a company. It's not like you're responsible for the actions of your employees outside the workplace at all hours of the day. But as seems to be the case here, in the name of Northwestern football and as part of the Northwestern football culture, in the locker room, at practices, after practices, on, you know, school facilities, this stuff was happening. That is on your watch. It's not some party that was happening, you know, in Florida over spring break or something. It's like this was a part of being a member of the Northwestern football team, right?
But we don't know how pervasive it was either. We're talking about over a dozen years. 11 names have surfaced now, or 11 players, not 11 names. But I don't know how obvious it was over more than a decade.
What we do have is the Hickey report saying that the claims made were largely supported by the evidence. And I'm now getting into which specific claims and how largely they were supported. Maybe that's something we need to look into. But those claims were more than just this happened to me as an individual. That was certainly a big part of it. It was this was happening to all of us at the time, and I'm the one who's speaking out, right? It wasn't just 12. This happened to 12 individuals. 12 individuals have spoken up, and they've said that it's happened. It was happening to more than just them, right?
I wish we knew how endemic it was then. We don't. They have not released the full report. We have a two-page summary.
And that's why I sort of hope that we get some discovery or even a trial in Pat Fitzgerald's legal action against Northwestern. I'd like to find out more about just what was said and what he is saying. He hasn't really said much, if anything.
Oh, no, not a thing. Not to my knowledge. The report said the investigation did not cover sufficient evidence. Sufficient's an interesting word there, isn't it, Pete? My producer keeps saying, what was that one word that they said? It's not that they didn't have evidence, but they didn't have sufficient evidence. It said the investigation did not uncover sufficient evidence to believe that the coaching staff knew about the ongoing hazing conduct. So Pat Fitzgerald or apologists like me can say, see, I told you, even the report said they didn't know. but they did determine that there had been significant opportunities to discover the reported hazing. So that's pretty inconclusive, isn't it? So you didn't know, but you had plenty of opportunity to know. So that does make it look like they were conveniently. It's so easy to now extrapolate from that. And the report doesn't say, and therefore they should have, but that's the inference, isn't it? Therefore they should have known. Those look like mixed messages to me. The report said there was no credible evidence that Fitzgerald knew about the hazing. And I'm also just interested in this. Do you guys think that if the initial punishment had been more than two weeks suspension with no pay, if the punishment more approximately fit the crime, that we wouldn't be here today? But it was such a brush off. It almost begged a little closer examination of what really happened. Like, wow, that sounds pretty weird. That sounds pretty awful. How awful was it? Oh, wait, 2 weeks? And now it sounds like you're not even taking this seriously. If they had said six months or a year no pay and he can come back in 2025, something like that, then maybe there would not have been this hyper investigation into what really happened. They could have helped him out, maybe, if they had punished him more severely out of the gate.
Or if they'd done some of the reporting that the Daily Northwestern did first and had fronted that information, because it was one of those, you know, death by a couple more cuts, thousand more cuts, right? That if their initial report had said, we found all this and we're suspending him for, let's say, 2 months, yeah, right into the middle of the season.
Yeah.
That's a very serious sanction, especially when you're talking about, I think he's making $5 million a year. He's probably losing $1 million and a great deal of shame and certainly a strong message being sent by that. I am not so sure that he is an irredeemable figure, that this is something that shows such incredible malfeasance on his part that he never deserves to coach a football team again. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but given the way it rolled out, John, I think you're exactly right. I think there's that it looked like such a week, and also in the summer, right? I mean, it wasn't like even a 2-game suspension. It was like 2 weeks. Like, that isn't that when college football coaches, well, probably not, but I'm saying they go on vacation. That's when everybody else goes on vacation.
Well, the AD was on vacation, and some of the other people weren't around. You know, there's an interesting op-ed at InsideNU.com, which is a website not affiliated with the university but follows Northwestern sports, InsideNU.com. And I'll just read you a couple of quotes from Ignacio Dowling's piece here. He said, "The silence of one man near the center of it all has been deafening, that of athletic director Derek Gragg. Whether that falls on him or the university for advising him to remain silent, that is inexcusable for the leader of a department in crisis. Gragg has not shared any statement publicly. Gragg has not even publicly acknowledged any of these situations exist. In fact, according to ESPN's Adam Rittenberg, he did not even return to Northwestern's campus until Tuesday morning. Granted, he was, I think, in Europe, and maybe you can't get there in time. He had a Zoom meeting with staff, and that was kind of blew up on them. In 4 days, there has not been a statement or a press conference nor a letter from Gragg, nothing. They've been not only not transparent, not even available." Yeah. Well, just one other thing. I was listening to sports radio when they were talking about this up and down the dial this week, and some of the on-air personalities were saying things like, "I thought I knew Pat Fitzgerald. He seemed like such a good guy." I think he is a good guy. I think these things can coexist as well. I think that's just why it's hard to believe that this happened under his watch, because if he was conveniently looking away, that doesn't sound consistent with the sort of person I thought he was. I would want him to coach my college program. I'd want him to coach my Little League team. And then you find this out and you go, how is that possible, unless he's telling the truth? That's why I keep falling back on my very limited knowledge of him or what happened here. But what I do know about him, I like and believe. So it's hard for me to believe that this was somebody who was letting something go on that terrible because he didn't want to do anything about it.
I would just echo the sort of what I said at the beginning. If this sort of behavior was happening in a large enterprise in the private sector, the CEO would be fired. That doesn't mean the CEO is a sexual predator or a demon or a horrible person. It just means that they failed at managing sort of this critical part of their enterprise. And that can be recognized as a failure. And the corrective action is that you move on to the next opportunity. I don't I don't think it necessarily means, especially because we still have yet to find out some details about this investigation, that the person themselves is, you know, a horrible monster by any means.
Yeah, I think if Pat Fitzgerald still wants to coach, he will be given the opportunity. You may remember there was a coach at Baylor named Art Briles. That man's been pariahed from coaching, but he had NCAA violations and investigations and a heap load of stuff. Pat Fitzgerald doesn't have any of that going on. So I think he's still got leeway. If he wants to be an assistant somewhere or be a head coach somewhere, it'll probably happen.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Louisville basketball coach.
Patino.
Patino. He landed on his feet eventually. Heck, his son got a job based on the father's name. And so maybe there's a second life. By the way, Eric in the Picayune Sentinel and on my radio show this week talked about Threads versus Twitter a little bit. Threads, as a competitor to Twitter, launched, and within a week's time, it has 100 million users. I'm one. Brandon, are you on Threads?
I am on Threads, unfortunately, yes.
And Eric and Austin, you are as well. Why do you say unfortunately, Brandon?
I just feel that this social media overload, trying to find all these Twitter replacements, it's becoming overwhelming. I barely have time to keep up with the social media we already have. I just feel like this Threads thing is just another thing I have to manage. So I'm dreading it because I also don't think Twitter is going to die. I think Twitter is always going to exist, honestly. And we're still going to have Threads and all these other competitors trying to make a name for themselves. But Twitter is the big beast. Twitter is still going to be there.
It's the start of what to me seems similar to sort of the streaming wars post Netflix, where you'll have every social media company now saying things like, okay, if I'm Snapchat, why wouldn't I start up kind of a text-based Twitter clone? I'm not going to get 100% of the market, but maybe I'll get 5 or 10% of it. And that's like a pretty substantial business if you get 5 or 10% of that market. So I think in terms of user experience so far, there's a couple of notable things. One is that it's funny watching people who are amazing visual content creators that you're following on Instagram for their visual content try to do written word stuff, and it just like doesn't work. Like it seems wrong. It's like when you see someone from a cooking show on Dancing with the Stars or something, like a famous chef. They're in the wrong place.
This isn't your format.
So there's that. And then the other thing, which was a very sneaky thing that they did, is that you can deactivate your Threads profile, but you cannot, or you can delete it. I don't know if it's delete or deactivate. You can't completely wipe it off the record unless you also delete your Instagram account.
Right.
So that's how they're going to keep people with at least the app.
You can't get Threads without Instagram. And if you want to delete Instagram or Threads, then are you saying you have to stop using Instagram?
Right.
That they're tied together?
I was just going to say the only selling point Threads has at this point is that they're not Twitter. If you use the product, it's not a great product right now. The hashtags don't even work. They don't even have hashtags to follow conversations. One of the most basic functions of social media is not there on Threads yet. It's like Twitter 2008.
You can't edit.
It was not ready for prime time. Totally. And it lacks a bunch of different functions. One is you can't follow like breaking news. You can't. I couldn't create like a small subgroup that I could follow, say during a trial. And I do this all the time when there's a trial at the federal building. I'll create a little separate list of reporters who I know are in the courtroom, and then I can just follow all their tweets from the courtroom. Federal trials, even Cook County trials. And that you can follow news events that way, or you could search for, say, you know, Chicago floods if we're going to get more flooding, and just follow tweets on that. It's like a dog's breakfast of things when you look at your Threads feed right now, because you aren't able to separate them and sort them out and follow some people and not others, even for a time. It's just, and then all these people who you don't follow, you're reading their tweets as well, or Threads as well, and it seems like a mess right now. And I'm, like I said, I'm willing to wait and see what's going to happen with this, but I am not. So I am not leaving Twitter for this.
Brandon said there's no hashtag. So in other words, if I wanted to follow the NU football scandal, I can't type in something that will just feed to me whatever people are saying about Northwestern football?
You could search for people. You could search for Rick Talender or something.
Sure,
like that,
sure.
Or Paul Sullivan.
No, but so I want a stream of just Northwestern football from the universe.
As far as I know, no. I've had no luck.
And you can't. The other thing you can't get is and Twitter put this back, which I think is great. You can either do just plug me into the matrix and give me whatever you think is great, or just show me what all my followers are tweeting in order, or what all the people I'm following, what they're tweeting in order. And there's two yeah. modes.
Right.
Threads is just, you know, here's what we think you'll like.
And there's no good desktop app right now. That it's only on your phone.
It's not at all.
So you can't. And Twitter has a nice desktop functionality and a good iPad functionality, and I like that too. I don't think enough people have left Twitter yet to have it be something that you're just going to abandon. Also, Twitter covers news much better right now than Threads does, and news is what I'm interested in usually, not necessarily recipes. Or I'm not really big on Instagram. I'll peek in on it once in a while, and I'll post a few times a year, but Twitter is where it's at for me still, despite everything that Elon Musk has done to screw it up. I still think it's my platform of choice.
I think in 5 years from now, I'm curious what it's going to look like. I wouldn't be surprised if we see Twitter become more of a right-wing social media platform. You see Threads become the platform for more of the left-wing and POC. And then the other ecosystem, you have these hyper-focused apps, kind of like the new Spill app for Black people, Blue Sky for the nerdy nerds out there. Just all these hyper-focused apps out there to further kind of show the divides we kind of have within the country already. I just feel like social media is already getting to be that way. And it looks like the way people are reacting to Twitter with Elon Musk is very much a blue-red divide. And I can see it playing out and see that being the reality going forward. The big factor is going to be, can Twitter remain profitable to have that actually happen and also do that off the backs of just one segment of the country? I think they can if Elon Musk can get his stuff together. It's still got the brand power to stay relevant. Just a matter of, does it have the functionality to have profit and stay up to date?
Right. And the news reports say that Twitter usage is down significantly now. And I've noticed that one of the things that I do for my newsletter is I go out and find tweets that I think are funny and present them to my readers and ask them to vote on them. And I'm finding that much harder lately. In the last couple of months, as people defect from, some people just have turned off Twitter altogether. Some have gone to Mastodon, Blue Sky, some of these other things. I'm finding it harder and harder because people are leaving. People who were reliably providing me good content aren't there anymore. So I have noticed that. I do think, though, that this idea that I'm going to turn my whole social media life over to Mark Zuckerberg is a little creepy. Like, I'm already on Facebook. I'm already on Instagram. If I'm on Threads, that's three platforms that are all part of Meta, right? I would like to spread that around a little bit so that all that information is not in the hands of one company. We'll see. I do think that there are enough good engineers and smart people at places like Meta that they could make Threads as versatile, if not more versatile, than Twitter, and they could do a better job of content moderation than Twitter is now doing. So that if you emulate Twitter enough and make it attractive enough and give it all the functionality of Twitter, it could take over. On the other hand, there are also examples in the past in social media where big companies have come in and tried to Bigfoot some other service. I'm thinking of Google Plus. Remember when Google Plus came in and it was going to take over and it was going to kill Facebook? And people tried it and they just didn't like it. It wasn't as good. It wasn't as useful. It wasn't as attractive. And it died. I think it died about 5 years ago. So it's not necessarily a given that even with the power that Meta has, that it's going to take over that particular kind of microblogging platform on social media.
I think one thing that did help it, though, was the fact that you could take your Instagram following and have it carry over to Threads.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things I find most draining about maintaining a social media following is building it. And so to have to do that on multiple new applications is really stress and anxiety inducing. So it was a great, you know, relief off my shoulders to see that when I got on Threads, I already got people I follow, people following me. I can just jump right in. Don't have to worry about building really much of anything. So they have a little bit of a leg up in that capacity. Just curious if they can build on that.
It's proof how unpopular Elon Musk is that we're rooting for Mark Zuckerberg, isn't it? But that's yeah. That's where I am. I so dislike some of the things that Elon Musk has said or stands for now that I'll cut off my nose to spite my face. I'll go ahead and take this not ready for primetime app just because I don't want to be on Twitter. And I do think that they will get it figured out. I mean, some of these things aren't that novel, like an edit button or how to generate a hashtag and follow a evolving story. I don't know why they did it, except that Twitter is reeling right now. They've got so much debt, and they seem to be doing so many counterproductive things, limiting the amount of views you can get. I mean, that's how you generate revenue, isn't it? It's by eyeballs on posts, and now they're saying you're going to have to pay after a certain point. Maybe that won't stick, but that was another Elon Musk idea, and that seemed counterproductive.
Oh, I just think that's why Threads jumped in now.
Threads jumped in because Twitter
seems to be reeling, and because I think they really weren't ready to launch. I have that feeling. I don't think this product is ready yet.
But I also, though, I'll bet you by Christmas, it's toast. What is this, July? Okay, give me 9 months. Twitter is gone. Is dead. It doesn't exist anymore. It's deplatformed. They aren't taking any new people because they can't. He's having to sell shares of his other companies just to pay the debt on Twitter. It was such a stupid deal. So give me 9 months from July 12th, 2023.
Let me mark it down. Yes. Let me mark this down.
Hey, if I'm wrong, sue me. I don't care. Whatever. I'm just throwing that out there.
flag the tape.
Yeah, flag the tape.
Rumors of Twitter's downfall, I think, are greatly exaggerated. They're greatly exaggerated. Obviously, there's a ton of debt. Obviously, this guy paid way too much to own Twitter. But underpriced attention is still on Twitter. Tons and tons of people are still on Twitter. It might seem easy to make a Twitter competitor, and many people, I think, will and keep nipping at their heels. As Eric's very good Google Plus example showed, it's not that easy, and there's so many factors at play. I think especially the thing about throttling usage, that was an own goal in terms of the communication of that. I don't know a single person in real life who had any of their usage throttled. It was just the perception that, I could be on here for 12 hours. It's like saying I can't, I could, it's important that I sleep 8 hours every 48 hours. Like you're telling me everybody's got to be asleep or something. No, it's just you can't have, the reason that policy was in place is because there's lots of social listening tools and other crawlers and bots on Twitter that were totally taking advantage of the company by hoovering up millions and millions and millions of tweets every single day.
They're scraping off of Twitter.
That contributed nothing to the bottom line of the company. So that makes sense as a policy. But to say, the human psychology of saying your use of it is limited was very dumb, because nobody wants their use of something limited, right?
You don't think that I'm going to get to 600 or 800 posts, but I'm looking at my phone right now, and I'm just scrolling. I'm scrolling on Twitter. I'll bet I just went through 25 posts, right? It's
right.
Possible, but I would hit that limit in a given day.
That was the last straw for a lot of people, because I know for me, the 600 thing, all of a sudden, I mean, you scrolling through within 5 minutes, you reach 600 tweets. It just made the app completely ineffective and just kind of dumb. And so it was kind of the last straw for me too. I really didn't think seriously about leaving Twitter until the view, what was it called? Limit count not reached or exceeded or something.
So you reached it,
yeah.
and it stopped you?
I haven't.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
Really?
I think it was a weekend. It wasn't a weekend. I was just scrolling through. I think it was may have been NASCAR.
And then you got a message that said you can't view any more stuff today?
Any tweet that I saw underneath it wouldn't let me see any tweets underneath. It said my account was done. It just made I couldn't look at photos, videos, anything. So it just was like, why do I have this app? Why are we doing this?
They should have a message after that that says, go outside and play ball. Go for a walk.
What if I'm outside walking and tweeting at the same time? I should be able to do both.
I want to talk about this story, guys. Chicago Police Union vows.
Hey, guys, I'm gonna bounce out, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Good to talk to you, Brandon. Thank you.
Thanks, Brandon. Talk to you soon.
There goes Brandon. See you guys. Chicago Police Union vows court fight over rejected demand for 12 weeks of paid parental leave. Didn't one of you guys predict that this was going to happen or something like this would happen after Brandon Johnson said that the teachers should get 12 weeks of paid parental leave? You know, his former union, now he's doing them a solid by granting them 12 weeks of paid parental leave, but they aren't doing it for the Chicago police officers. And John Catanzara's got something to say about that, the Fraternal Order of Police president. Brandon or Austin, this is kind of your area. Just tell me what I should know about this story.
Brandon Johnson announced that he would be giving 12 weeks of paid parental leave to all Chicago Public Schools employees. And we talked about that. And at the time, I said, whether you agree with this policy or not, the important thing is that it was not bargained over at all. So there was no give and take. It was just a pure giveaway. And what happens when you give a pure giveaway to a certain group of workers in your city government, guess what every other worker is going to want to do? Everyone else is going to have the gimme, gimme, gimme mentality. And that's the Chicago police officers are now saying, well, what if it's good enough for teachers? Why isn't it good enough for us? Our jobs are really hard, too. Why can't we have this? The response from Brandon Johnson's camp on this is essentially that, well, Chicago police officers have 365 sick days over a 2-year period, which I have not checked that is an actual number. There is a really disproportionate number of sick days that Chicago police officers do get. So they were saying basically, well, it's not apples to apples because in Chicago public schools, our educators are having to do this really barbaric thing of like saving up their sick days so they can have a kid and leave school and still be able to get paid. And so that's why we need this policy. The police don't have to deal with that. So they don't, you know, they don't need this policy. It's true that it's not apples to apples, but the Chicago police officers, essentially, that's a form of deferred compensation. Like mm-hmm, people mm-hmm. are cashing that in at the end of their career.
Yeah.
And similar to there was a policy in Chicago public schools called the pension pickup, where at some point, I believe this was in the 90s or early 2000s. Instead of giving teachers raises over 3 years, they got this deal where the school district would pay their entire contribution, the employee contribution to their pension, for example. So that was like a sweetener. Sick days are the same thing for police. But it all goes back to the same point, which was you cannot appear favorable or act that way to one certain segment of employees in the city government, because it's going to create this domino effect where people think they can get something for nothing. And that is not something Chicago can afford.
Brandon Johnson, when he did grant this to the Chicago public school employees, said, you shouldn't have to bargain for this. This is something you should just have in and of itself. We had this conversation a few weeks ago, right, Austin? And I think I was arguing that does make sense. I mean, I see that's a bargaining chip you could use, but by the same token, you shouldn't. It's, you know, even though you have that in your back pocket, if it's kind of a fundamental thing that we should grant to employees, let's grant it to these employees. But lo and behold, here comes another group of workers that want it too.
They don't actually think that it's not something to be bargained for, because guess what's going to be at the bargaining table next time for the police officers and every other union? It's 12 weeks paid parental leave. And is the city going to give that to every single employee of the city government? Clearly, they're not. They're not. They could do that right now without bargaining. And I think that's a real problem for this administration. And they're going to continue to do things like this that will cost the city a ton of money. And again, I think there's a very compelling argument to be made that especially in the teaching profession, in order to retain talent, this is something you need in order to get talent in the door. But there's many other things you can change about the collective bargaining agreement with the Chicago Teachers Union that you should make in addition to this, so that it's a fair fight. Otherwise, it's going to be a giveaway for everybody.
I mean, isn't this sort of part of what we're seeing from Brandon Johnson, which is he's got a lot of ideas that are, to my mind, quite good, but he doesn't seem to really have any strong ideas of how he's going to pay for them. And this is just a small example, but the Sun-Times had a really good editorial the other day talking about, you know, this transition report that he issued several months after he's transitioned into office, talks a lot, has a lot of aspirational goals about reopening mental health clinics and giving kids born in Chicago college scholarships and just all kinds of ideas, many of which, like I said, sound good to me. But he doesn't seem to, I mean, he's very aspirational, but when it comes down to like how you're going to pay for it, he doesn't really seem to have any ideas other than let's make rich people pay for it. And that doesn't seem to be going where he wants it to be going.
That transition report is really interesting. It's like a 200 plus page document, but it was similar. My friend Stu Loren said this on Twitter. He's a good follow, S-T-U-L-O-R-E-N. And he said basically, which is exactly correct, that it was akin to trying to do the interior decorating in a penthouse before you build the foundation for the skyscraper itself. It is all of these pie in the sky, really lofty goals, tons of social programs, all this quote unquote investment in all of these quote unquote investments. But there is absolutely no way to pay for it. And before you talk about those lofty pie in the sky goals, you really have to get your basics right as a city. You need to have good jobs and good amenities and good public services and safe and clean streets, reasonable cost of living. And those things don't get fixed by adding tons and tons of new spending and debt. They just don't.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that somebody campaigned on things that maybe they can't follow up on? Because that's shocking. I'm shocked to hear this, I say.
I'm a little shocked, John, that I hear what you're saying, but I'm a little shocked that he's sort of doubling down even now. I mean, generally, once you're elected, you go, yeah. I mean, you just right. go like, well, I've looked at the books yeah. and gosh, I can't do all I want. I mean, yes. he's been in office for 2 months and now he comes in and has all these very aspirational ideas. And that was one of my real reservations about him when he was campaigning, which is like, this guy is talking like an activist and thinking like someone who, like I said, like, Austin's at a pie in the sky kind of guy. Like we got all these things that we need to do and to build the city, but it doesn't seem to be grounded in sort of fiscal reality. And that's, you know, I mean, and it's going to lead to, I think, a lot of disillusionment on the part of voters. And some of them are going to say, like, wait a minute, Johnson promised us all this stuff, and he hasn't been able to deliver on hardly any of it.
You almost think somebody should have tapped him on the shoulder lately and just said, dude, you won. You don't have to talk like that anymore. You're in. Now you got to go the other way. Although, do you guys have any sympathy for the police? The 4th of July, all vacation canceled. I don't know what it is like to be a cop or how much time you get off or how much time you get to have off with your family when everybody else is taking time off. But it seems to me like being a police officer, especially with 12-hour shifts and no vacation or vacation frequently canceled, that's a very difficult job, and it only gets more difficult these days. So I have a little maybe sympathy in my heart when they say, well, but can we get the 12 weeks of paid parental leave? That's not vacation. That just seems to be a reasonable thing. Austin, maybe everybody should get it. If the teacher should get it, maybe you're right. Maybe everybody should get that. That's not the end of the world, is it?
It'd be really tough to implement a policy right now in the Chicago Police Department that says, if you have a child, you're going to be paid for 12 weeks and you're not going to show up to work. And that's what actually I think was a little misleading about. It was Jason Lee. It was Johnson's senior advisor, I think his highest ranking policy advisor, saying it's not apples to apples. But it's not like police officers right now can say, I'm taking 12 weeks of sick days to go do parental leave. Like, they don't have it currently. And that was sort of what Johnson was insinuating, which I don't think is correct. But no, like, again, we're in the services business as a city. And so you have to do a lot of management of your workforce. I don't think we're in a position as a city where every single employee of the city, while many of the taxpayers do not have this benefit, can afford to just give everybody, you know, 12 weeks of paid leave. And This is the fiscal reality that he is going to confront, which he clearly has not yet, is that in Chicago, more than 40% of the money that our city spends is going to fixed costs, debt, interest on debit, and these liabilities. They're not going to city services. So until you really address that head on, you are not going to be able to free up money for any kinds of these new social demands or programs that you want. You have to address that.
two other little quick notes before we wrap up this week's pod. I'm looking at a poll of downstate potential voters in Illinois' 12th GOP primary. Mike Bost, 43%, and Darren Bailey, the failed gubernatorial candidate, is now running for a seat that Bost has had, I think, for five terms, right? So he's kind of a mainstay. He's a tried and true conservative Republican downstate, but Darren Bailey wants to be in Congress now, and he's got 37% to Bost's 43%. Maybe that shows why he couldn't win the state, because he's so conservative that he can even take on a Mike Bost and have a good showing. And 21% are undecided. So maybe this thing ain't over yet. Maybe Darren Bailey will be a member of Congress, if you can get your head around that.
Well, Darren Bailey has got a lot of name recognition because of his run for governor. So that doesn't surprise me that he's polling that high.
Well, but Bost is the incumbent. He's got plenty of name recognition in his district, too, right? I mean, who do you think out of the gate has the advantage? It's always the incumbent, right, Eric?
It's going to be the incumbent, right. But it's the same thing we talked about JFK Jr. or RFK Jr.'s polling numbers. And I think that's a lot of name recognition and going on there. I wouldn't give Bailey a big chance in that district.
And Adam Kinzinger, the former Illinois congressman, this is from Politico, is not endorsing for president yet. Kinzinger isn't. I wonder if anybody in the GOP wants his endorsement. But he wants to see Chris Christie on the debate stage next month. Kinzinger's PAC has sent out an email encouraging donors to give to Christie's campaign. Next month's GOP debate in Milwaukee has rigid criteria. You got to secure 40,000 donors for the first debate. Christie isn't there yet. According to the pitch, if he doesn't meet the threshold, there will be no one on stage to say the emperor has no clothes. My understanding is Trump's not even going to participate in that debate, or at least I've been reading that he might not. He doesn't need to be in that debate.
I certainly hope Christie is able to lure Trump on stage by taunting him the way he has been, and calling him a chicken and saying that if he can't stand up to me, how is he going to stand up to, you know, foreign leaders and whatever. I like a lot of what Christie says about Trump. So I hope that he's able to get those donations and that he's able to be on stage.
Yeah. And go ahead, Austin. You open your mouth.
I think I think that minimum requirement makes sense as a threshold, but because it exists, there's a lot of funny schemes to get there. So Vivek Ramaswamy is giving supporters a 10% cut of the total money that he raises for his campaign to hit that number. And I think, you know, it's really hard to set those standards because sometimes they can be easy to game.
He said he had it a long time ago. The Swami said he had 40,000, right?
But yeah, I think he's closing in on like 65,000. But, you know.
But is he saying he's going to pay people who sign his petition? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, yes. If you're giving money to him, there will be some kind of return on your money from the bigger pool, like a really tiny amount. You'll get some tiny amount back.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, an incentive to donate. Yeah, you could see, like, for an example, if this was a rule in the Democratic primary, why wouldn't Mike Bloomberg just send $100 to 40,000 people and then say, hey, give me back 95? You know, right? Why wouldn't he do that to hit the threshold?
It's illegal to buy votes, you know, to pay for votes if you're running for office, unless you're Willie Wilson. But I guess the rules in a primary are different, huh?
Maybe. I guess I don't know where the line is. If you get money back for donating to a candidate, is that a bribe? If you get some kind of like discount, I guess we'll find out.
Well, is there a threshold for the amount of donation you have to get? I mean, could you get 40,000 $1 donations?
I think so.
The threshold is 40,000 individual donors.
Regardless of
the
amount.
Number of people giving you. Yeah.
Hey, one last thing. In the Emmys, the primetime nominees just came out today. I will only ask you about two categories: Outstanding Drama Series, Outstanding Comedy Series. In the Outstanding Comedy Series, tell me if you've watched any of these and who you would vote for if you could. Abbott Elementary. These are the comedies. Barry, which is hilarious, Barry, comedy. The Bear, not a funny show. Jury Duty, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Only Murders in the Building, Ted Lasso, Wednesday. I know you didn't watch them all. I suspect you didn't watch them all. But of the ones you watched, which would you vote for? How about you, Austin?
Jury Duty. I would put Jury Duty as best drama also.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because The Bear and Barry are Barry was a violent show. I know Bill Hader's a funny guy, but that was not primarily a funny show, even if it had the Fonz. How about you, Eric?
Well, I would. I mean, I really like The Bear, and I think I like it better than Ted Lasso. But as a comedy, Ted Lasso exceeds The Bear. So that, I would go with Ted Lasso.
I think I go with The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Outstanding drama series: Andor, Better Call Saul, The Crown, House of the Dragon, The Last of Us, Succession, White Lotus, Yellowjackets.
Succession.
Yeah, how does that not win, right? I really thought White Lotus' second season was so good. And there were times where Succession was exasperating, but I think I would go with Succession, too. How about you, Austin?
Yeah, I didn't watch the full season of Succession. I did watch the full season of White Lotus. I would probably say White Lotus, except for the fact that the first season of it set the bar so high, and I don't think it was as good as the first season.
And Better Call Saul was good, too. That show's always good, so one of them will win.
You know, you're listening to all these shows, and it's like it really strikes me how high the quality is these days on streaming TV. That there's a lot of story. I've read a lot of stories about how movie theaters and dramatic theaters, playhouses, are having a lot of trouble. And I think, you know, the pandemic certainly played into that. But I think the fact that you can stay home and watch such high quality stuff that, you know, you think, do I want to spend $50 for a ticket or if you got to get a babysitter and all that other stuff? I think the quality of TV is really hurting some theaters and cinemas.
Yeah, that may be part of that. Okay, Brandon clicked out. Austin, Eric, nice to see you guys. Thanks for being part of the pod this week.
Good to see you. Thanks, Dr. Sam.
Yeah.
We're produced by Ben Anderson, not Brandon Johnson, and Pete Zimmerman. And there's Bob Ferguson, engineering this week. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.